Chapter 38. Lenin returns to Russia. In March 1917, Lenin is almost unknown in Europe except among a few groups of the extreme left. German intelligence, however, knew who Lenin was. He was more powerful than a million Russian soldiers. The Austrians could have captured him at the beginning of August 1914 in Krakow, Poland, but they let him escape to Switzerland. For 2.5 years he lived in a room atop a Zurich sausage factory, breathing its rank fumes. He had no money and often thought of committing suicide. He seemed to have lost hope of ever coming to power. "We are old and we will not live to see the decisive battles of the revolution." Lenin represented the hard core of the revolution. He was uncompromising and could not stand half solutions. The whole bourgeois system had to be smashed to bits. There would be no quarter, no concessions. He had become a deadly enemy of the moderate left, which he saw as compromised in both ideology and action. Lenin would rather wander in the political desert than tolerate any sort of social democrat or Menshevik. Moderate revolutionaries sickened him. He regarded them as false revolutionaries. He had no time for soft organizations and believed that the revolution had to be handled by specialists or professional revolutionary technicians, as he called them. Crowds were only useful in the framework of an iron organization, subordinated to professional revolutionaries. He compared the implementation of revolution to a surgical procedure. Everything had to be prepared, cold-blooded, and skilled. Lenin's will was cold and indomitable. Those who knew him said he was all brain. He certainly was the brain of the revolution. When he died, his brain was measured at 1,700 cubic millimeters, among the largest ever recorded. Now his mental power would change the world. In 1914, the Bolshevik Party had consisted of only a few people in Russia. There were 7 members of the directorate, 3 of whom were undercover police. Lenin had to flee to Krakow and then to Switzerland. His mood alternated from suicidal at his lack of means to elation at the raging world war. He savored the titanic clash of the world's imperialist and bourgeois powers and saw war as the salvation of Bolshevism. "Without the war," he wrote, "we would see the union of all the capitalists against us." He regarded the devastation of Europe as the clearing away of obstacles for building universal communism. For Germany, Lenin represented the last chance to pry Russia away from the Allies. The March 1917 upheaval in St. Petersburg had overthrown the Tsar but kept Russia in the war. The Germans felt Lenin had the power to plunge Russia in a bloody all-consuming revolution which would make it impossible to continue the war against Germany. The Allies had not the slightest knowledge of Lenin, but the Germans had had him under close scrutiny since 1914. The decision to use Lenin was not taken lightly. The Germans were well aware that Lenin wanted to bring down Imperial Germany even more than Imperial Russia. For Lenin, world revolution was to start from Germany, not Russia. Germany had a ready-made mass of workers organized along political lines, and the socialists were close to a majority in the Reichstag. Russia, on the other hand, was composed of 80% peasants and 2% workers, who were unorganized and unindoctrinated. Only war, by displacing the peasants from their land, would make them susceptible to indoctrination. The notion that they could own the land they tilled would bring them to communism, although Lenin did not consider them a major asset compared to the enormous German proletariat. Germany's decision to use Lenin in 1917 was ill-timed for his schemes for world conquest. His agreement to go to Russia was perhaps the greatest mistake of his life. If he had had the patience to wait another 18 months, he might have benefited from Germany's 1918 debacle and taken over Berlin in place of the mediocre Liebknecht. Lenin had the genius for organization and action which Liebknecht lacked. He might easily have imposed his will on Germany. The right man at the right place at the right time, he could have launched his world revolution from Germany and swept Europe away. Lenin always regarded his action in St. Petersburg as secondary. His prime interest was in Germany. He was not interested in any country as such, but only in its revolutionary potential. Yet although he knew Germany offered the most fertile ground, Lenin opted to lead the revolution in St. Petersburg. For once his cold reasoning was overruled by his need for action. When the Germans knocked at his door, he could not resist the call to organize a revolution, even in the wrong country. The Germans played their Lenin card with mathematical precision, but politics, like war, can be full of surprises. They expected Lenin to put a swift end to the armchair revolutionaries who had committed Russia to the Allies' war, yet Lenin almost failed and had to flee to Finland for safety. Trotsky was still in New York and Stalin, although back from Siberia, was in hiding. Other communist leaders had not fared well in the March Revolution, demonstrating themselves to be mediocrities. In fact, some Germans had favored backing Stalin, they thought they could control him more easily than Lenin. Both Lenin and Stalin were regarded as akin to germ warfare, the virus had to bring down a hostile neighbor without affecting those who had released it. Would the virus die off after having performed its assigned task? Could it be contained? These were the questions which preoccupied the German high command. The Germans would achieve the first phase of their objective, Lenin would eventually put an end to Russia's participation in the war. The second phase was to destroy or contain the deadly virus. Lenin's duplicity, however, was greater than that of any German Machiavelli, he quickly demonstrated who was using whom. A willing tool of the Germans because they had given him the opportunity to implement his revolution, now that he had what he wanted, Lenin felt free to turn against Germany. Once in power, Lenin would develop a policy of no war, no peace, which would drag the Germans into months of sterile talks. Germany remained an inch short of victory, but was doomed to remain there until its defeat. Originally, Lenin had tried to bypass the German authorities, planning to cross Germany clandestinely, with a forged Scandinavian passport and a false beard and wig. Trotsky recalled, all the plans of escape with makeup, wigs, and false passports collapsed one after another. Before leaving Zurich, Lenin had been appalled at the bourgeois character of the March Revolution. He sent a telegram to his followers in St. Petersburg, absolute suspicion. Deny the new government any backing. Our party would be shamed forever if it became involved in such treason. I would rather break with anyone in our party if that person were going to make any type of concessions to social patriotism. Concessions were, however, being made at this very moment by his Bolshevik comrade Leon Rosenfeld, also known as George Kamenev, together with the 19 Bolshevik delegates to the government council. Overcoming its fear and repugnance of the part Jewish communist leader, the German government made a special sealed train available to Lenin, his wife, and 15 other Bolsheviks of his choice. They were shipped across Germany to the Baltic Sea, where they stopped at Stockholm and finally reached St. Petersburg on April 3, 1917. The bourgeois revolutionaries sent a delegation to greet Lenin at the Finnish border. There they presented him with flowers, which he hated. All their eagerness to please left Lenin cold and contemptuous. He turned his back on them and delivered a short but radical speech. Lenin's attitude was reported to Kerensky and his entourage of craven politicians. They concluded that Lenin was driving a hard bargain. At the same time, they were dogged by a morbid fear that he did not simply want to join the political club and share its spoils with them. Kerensky had attempted to allay the fears of his colleagues, who had spread the word that Lenin was a German agent, "Just wait until Lenin arrives, and you will find out he is a good man." The accusation was meant to discredit Lenin in the eyes of Russian workers. The social patriots, as Trotsky called the bourgeois revolutionaries, had defined their policy toward Lenin in the Duma. The very fact that Lenin came back via Germany will harm his prestige to such an extent that there will be nothing more to fear from him. Lenin had anticipated this accusation. Before boarding the German train, he had garnered testimonials of good behavior from socialist leaders all across Europe, including the German Marxist theoretician Levy. One testimonial to his good Marxism, co-signed by Europe's Marxist luminaries, read, "The Russian internationalists who are now leaving for Russia to serve the revolution will be helping us by fostering uprisings among the proletarians of other countries, particularly those of Germany and Austria, against their own governments. The testimonial did not mention by what means that internationalists were returning to Russia, and the reference to particularly those of Germany and Austria was inserted at Lenin's request in order to refute the accusation that he was a German agent. The accusation was purely political. Lenin had been given money and the use of a train by Germany, but he was never an agent as such. He used the Germans for his own purpose, just as the Germans had used him for theirs. Lenin could hardly wait to destroy Imperial Germany once his Russian opportunity had been seized. Lenin was not the only recipient of foreign money. Trotsky received substantial funds from Jewish banker Jacob Schiff in September 1917. Schiff's correspondent in Stockholm, the Warburg Bank, even managed Trotsky's account in the Swedish capital. Lenin, like Trotsky, gladly accepted money wherever it came from. If the bankers wanted to invest in the business of revolution that was their business, Lenin would just use the money to achieve his goals. Lenin's eagerness to accept any kind of money led the financiers of the revolution to believe they would get a return on their investments. With the exception of the Jewish bankers, Lenin repaid his financial bankers not with money but with revolutions in their own countries. Lenin's policy was to dupe the enemy at all times. Agreements and debts were only valid in the eye of the bourgeois. For Lenin, they were the tools of expediency. In this respect, he proved himself the supreme dialectical materialist, far above any of his colleagues, who were always embarrassed to talk about Germany's financing of Lenin. The historical fact was that without the German millions and the Jewish millions, advanced at a critical time, Lenin's revolution and plans for world subversion would never have gotten off the ground. It was a ludicrous demonstration of Marxist prudery to promote the thesis that the revolution was financed by passing the hat among the proletariat. Communist historians have made themselves ridiculous in attempting to gloss over Lenin's most outstanding characteristic, his masterly handling of money in the service of his revolution. For Lenin, the notion at the end justified the means was never an issue. Although charges of German backing raised against Lenin had a certain impact, they were weakened by the mediocrity of those who made them. From March 1917 until Lenin's final grab for power, there were four successive governments within 7 months. They were all composed of bourgeois revolutionaries, each of which competed for the position of most inept and most mediocre. Their dismal performance would drive the disappointed masses to the one man who appeared to know what he wanted, Lenin. His talent for organization was everywhere apparent. Every street, every building, every factory was the target of Lenin's agents. He deftly manipulated, wrote Suvorin, the levers of the party and utilized professional revolutionaries to the best of their abilities, while at the same time justifying his tactical plan doctrinally. Peace had now become a popular issue. The bourgeois revolutionaries felt uneasy any time they heard the crowd shout, "Down with the war!" Tsarism had only recently been overthrown to the same, "down with the war," shouts. But the war kept going and people continued to die at the front and starve behind the lines. Everywhere the people had had enough. Lenin correctly sized up the situation. On March 27, 1917, the Petrograd Soviet publicly disavowed Milyukov and his promises to the Allies. The soldiers Soviet on the Eastern Front had voted overwhelmingly against continuation of the war, as indicated by the votes of their delegates at Minsk, 610 against 8. "Down with the war" was accompanied by "peace without annexations or reparations." This formula, devised by Lenin, was all the more clever because it aped the high-minded principles of President Wilson. Milyukov lost his ministry at the beginning of May 1917. Prince Lvov immediately made concessions, offering 5 seats to the socialists. He remained president purely for decorum's sake. The most powerful man at this time was War Minister Kerensky, but he did not put an end to the war. The soldiers repeated the slogan, "If peace is infamous, give us an infamous peace," from one end of the front to the other. Some priests got into the act by preaching peace at any cost. Deputy Patriarch Filonenki was cheered by the troops. "Soldiers," he declared at the Duma, "were kissing my hands and feet. Months went by and the frightful toll of war continued to mount, from the Baltic to the Caspian. Scurvy and typhus reaped a grim harvest. The bourgeois revolutionaries did nothing, and the soldiers just walked away from the front. In a few months, more than 2 million soldiers deserted. Most of them were peasants going home to take over the land that had been promised to them. Train loads of reinforcements would reach the front almost empty. Soldiers literally jumped out of them all along the route. French and British socialist leaders came to Russia to harangue their socialist counterparts in Petrograd. Their mission, they explained, was to rekindle the martial ardor of the Russian army. The visit proved embarrassing to the bourgeois revolutionaries. The British emissaries tried to salvage the situation by promising Constantinople to Russia as just one reward among many for remaining in a glorious war. Such promises only infuriated the people all the more, and the Allies were accused of practicing Pan-Slavic charlatanism. The Allied emissaries included wealthy French Communist Party boss Marcel Cachin, who was informed that the Russian government would support a popular plebiscite in Alsace-Lorraine after the war ended. The British were dumbfounded, and the Russian government proposed not only the liberation of peoples conquered during the war but of all oppressed peoples. Particular reference was made to the people of Egypt and Ireland. The British socialists were particularly shocked at the notion of liberating Ireland. The French socialists were also nervous at the prospect of liberating French colonies without the opportunity of socializing them first. Back in Paris and London, politicians of all stripes were wondering whether it was Wilson who had whispered such outrageous suggestions into the ears of the Russian government. The Allies were not about to let the Russian alliance disintegrate for the sake of policies which, even if agreed upon, were not to be implemented before the end of the war in any event. In that spirit, they agreed to the Russian radicals' slogans, peace without annexations or reparations, an internationally controlled plebiscite for Alsace-Lorraine, responsibility for the war belongs to everybody and everybody must participate in indemnifying the victims. In exchange for the acceptance of these terms, the Russian government was prepared to launch one last offensive to speed the end of the war. French General Nivelle bombarded the Russian high command with demands that General Alexeyev start the offensive immediately. Kerensky was still attempting to placate the Allies when he decided to go to the front and raise the troops' morale for a final battle. By then the Russian army was a mere facade. 70 generals had been discharged and many others had been assassinated by their men. Thousands of communist agents had virtually replaced the generals and were manipulating the troops for their own purpose. Kerensky, however, surprised many by his tireless efforts on the front from May 15 to June 24, 1917. Despite chaotic conditions, his oratory managed to inspire more than 300,000 men to fight one more battle. On June 24, 1917, the men were placed under the command of General Brusilov, and Kerensky ordered a new offensive. On July 1, 1917, Brusilov threw his 23 divisions in a 30-mile-wide assault with the objective of capturing Lemberg. The Russians broke through the Austrian-German lines and took 10,000 prisoners by nightfall. The gallant Russian effort was stymied, however, when two reserve divisions refused to follow up the day's victory. Brusilov conceded there was no way to force them to battle. The German high command, anticipating this last Russian offensive, had rushed six additional divisions to the 72 already fighting on the Eastern Front. The German counteroffensive was formidable. On July 19, 1917, the Germans drove Brusilov out of Galicia. Over the next 10 days, Brusilov would lose 160,000 men. On the Baltic front, General von Hüttier wiped out Russia's 12th Army and captured Riga, the largest port of the Baltic states. Russia had been dealt a devastating military blow. The news of Brusilov's offensive unleashed massive demonstrations in St. Petersburg. For the first time, the Bolsheviks mixed with the crowd for the purpose of directing it. Bolshevik agents shouted, "All power to the Soviets," ceaselessly, and soon the cry was taken up by other demonstrators. Leon Trotsky, Lev Davidovich Bronstein, had finally joined Lenin after being detained in London. Bronstein shed his New York name to become Trotsky, the communist leader, the right-hand man of Lenin. Both men were vehement and radical orators whose fiery speeches made the bourgeois revolutionaries sound quite insipid. The crowds flocked over to Lenin in droves. In June 1917, however, the Congress of Soviets was a long way from controlling Russia. 105 Bolsheviks had been elected to the Duma, but that only represented some 14% of the assembly. Lenin realized that the Russian proletariat was less conscious, less organized, less prepared than the proletariats in other countries, and he was anxious to get beyond the Russian state as quickly as possible. The revolution must be Europe-wide or it would fail. Socialism, explained Lenin, cannot win immediately or directly in Russia. With only 1/6 of the power in the hands of the Soviets, Lenin tried to explain his policies for solving Russia's problems directly to the people. The process was arduous, and he knew that only a dictatorship would enable him to consolidate power. Lenin knew the Bolsheviks could not reach power through laws, elections, and consensus, but only through force. Like a tiger, he waited for the precise moment when he could pounce, for he knew power was never given, but always taken.